Man's respect for knowledge is one of his most peculiar characteristics. Knowledge in Latin is scientia, and science came to be the name of the most respectable kind of knowledge. But what distinguishes knowledge from superstition, ideology, or pseudoscience? The Catholic Church excommunicated Copernicans. The Communist Party persecuted Mendelians on the ground that their doctrines were pseudoscientific. But then the problem of demarcation between science and pseudoscience is not merely a problem of armchair philosophy. It is of vital social and political relevance. Many philosophers have tried to solve the problem of demarcation in the following terms. A statement constitutes knowledge if sufficiently many people believe it sufficiently strongly. But the history of thought shows us that many people were totally committed to absurd beliefs. If the strength of beliefs were a hallmark of knowledge, we should have to rank some tales about demons, angels, devils, and of heaven and hell as knowledge. Scientists, on the other hand, are very skeptical even of their very best theories. Newton's is the most powerful theory science has yet produced, but Newton himself never believed that bodies attract each other at a distance. So no degree of commitment to beliefs makes them knowledge. Indeed, the hallmark of scientific behavior is a certain skepticism, even towards one's most cherished theories. Blind commitment to a theory is not an intellectual virtue, it is an intellectual crime. Thus, a statement may be pseudoscientific, even if it is eminently plausible and everybody believes in it. And it may be scientifically valuable, even if it is unbelievable and nobody believes in it. The cognitive value of a theory has nothing to do with its psychological influence on people's minds. Belief, commitment, understanding are states of the human mind. But the objective scientific value of a theory is independent of the human mind which creates it or understands it. Its scientific value depends only on what objective support these conjectures have in facts. As Hume said, if we take in our hand any volume of divinity or school metaphysics, for instance, let us ask, does it contain any abstract reasoning concerning quantity or number? No. Does it contain any experimental reasoning concerning matter of fact and existence? No. Commit it then to the flames, for it can contain nothing but sophistry and illusion. But what is exactly experimental reasoning? In scientific reasoning, theories are confronted with facts. And one of the central conditions of scientific reasoning is that theories must be supported by facts. Now, how exactly can facts support theory? Several different answers have been proposed. Newton himself thought that he proved his laws from facts. In particular, he claimed that he deduced his laws from the phenomena provided by Kepler. But his boast was nonsense, since according to Kepler, planets move in ellipses, but according to Newton's theory, planets would move in ellipses only if the planets did not disturb each other in their motion. But they do. This is why Newton had to devise a perturbation theory, from which it follows that no planet moves in an ellipse. One can today easily demonstrate that there can be no valid derivation of a law of nature from any finite number of facts. But we still keep reading about scientific theories being proven from facts. Why this stubborn resistance to elementary logic? There is a very plausible explanation. Scientists want to make their theories respectable, deserving of the title science, that is, genuine knowledge. Now, the most relevant knowledge in the 17th century, when science was born, concerned God, the devil, heaven, and hell. If one got one's conjectures about matters of divinity wrong, the consequence of one's mistake was no less than eternal damnation. Theological knowledge cannot be fallible. It must be beyond doubt. Now, the Enlightenment thought that we were fallible and ignorant about matters theological. There is no scientific theology, and therefore, no theological knowledge. knowledge can only be about nature. But this new type of knowledge had to be judged by the standards they took over straight from theology. It had to be proven beyond doubt. Science had to achieve the very certainty which had escaped theology. A scientist, worthy of the name, was not allowed to guess. He had to prove each sentence he uttered from facts. This was the criterion of scientific honesty. Theories unproven from facts were regarded as simple pseudoscience, heresy in the scientific community. It was only the downfall of Newtonian theory in this century which made scientists realize that their standards of honesty had been utopian. If all scientific theories are equally unprovable, what distinguishes then scientific knowledge from ignorance, science from pseudoscience? One answer to this question was provided in the 20th century by inductive logicians. Inductive logic set out to define the probabilities of different theories according to the available total evidence. If the mathematical probability of a theory is high, it qualifies as scientific. If it is low, or even zero, it is not scientific. Thus, the hallmark of scientific honesty would be never to say anything that isn't at least highly probable. But in 1934, Karl Popper, one of the most influential philosophers of our time, argued that the mathematical probability of all theories, whether scientific or pseudoscientific, given any amount of evidence, is zero. If Popper is right, scientific theories are not only equally unprovable, but also equally improbable. A new demarcation criterion was needed, and Popper proposed a rather stunning one. A theory is scientific if one is prepared to specify in advance a crucial experiment or observation which can falsify it, and it is pseudo-scientific if one refuses to specify such a potential falsifier. But if so, we do not demarcate scientific theories from pseudo-scientific ones, but rather scientific method from non-scientific method. Thus, a proposition may petrify into pseudo-scientific dogma or become genuine knowledge, depending on whether we are prepared to state observable conditions which would refute it. Is then Popper's falsifiability criterion the solution to the problem of demarcating science from pseudoscience? No. For Popper's criterion ignores the remarkable tenacity of scientific theories. Scientists have thick skins. They do not abandon a theory because facts contradict it. They normally either invent some rescue hypothesis to explain what they then call a mere anomaly, and if they cannot explain the anomaly, they ignore it. Note that scientists talk about anomalies and not refutations. History of science, of course, is full of accounts of how crucial experiments allegedly killed theories. But all such accounts are fabricated long after the theory had been abandoned. What is then the hallmark of science? Do we have to capitulate and agree that the scientific revolution is just an irrational change in commitment? That it is a religious conversion? Tom Kuhn, a distinguished American philosopher of science, arrived at this conclusion after discovering the naivety of Popper's falsificationism. But if Kuhn is right, then there is no explicit demarcation between science and pseudoscience. There is no distinction between scientific progress and intellectual decay. There is no objective standard of honesty. But what criteria can he then offer to demarcate scientific progress from intellectual degeneration? In the last few years, I have been advocating a methodology of scientific research programs which solves some of the problems which both Popper and Kuhn failed to solve. First, I claim that the typical descriptive unit of great scientific achievements is not an isolated hypothesis, but rather a research program. All swans are white, may be falsified by the discovery of one black swan. But such trivial trial and error doesn't rank as science. Newtonian science is not simply a set of four conjectures, the three laws of mechanics and the law of gravitation. These four laws constitute only the hard core of the Newtonian program. But this hard core is tenaciously protected from refutation by a vast protective belt of auxiliary hypotheses. And even more importantly, the research program has also a heuristic, that is, a powerful problem-solving machinery which, with the help of sophisticated mathematical techniques, digests anomalies and even turns them into positive evidence. For instance, if a planet doesn't move exactly as it should, the Newtonian scientist checks his conjectures concerning atmospheric refraction, concerning propagation of light in magnetic storms, hundreds of other conjectures, which are all part of the program. He may invent a hitherto unknown planet, calculate its position, mass and velocity, in order to explain the anomaly. Now, Newton's theory of gravitation, Einstein's relativity theory, quantum mechanics, Marxism, Freudism, are all research programs, each with a characteristic hard core stubbornly defended, each with its more flexible protective belt, and each with its elaborate problem-solving machinery. Each of them, at any stage of its development, has unsolved problems and undigested anomalies. All theories in this sense are born refuted and die refuted. But are they equally good? Until now, I have been describing what research programs are like. But how can one distinguish a scientific or progressive program from a pseudo-scientific or degenerating one? Contrary to Popper, the difference cannot be that some are still unrefuted while others already refuted. Kaufmann, a distinguished physicist, refuted Einstein's relativity theory in the very year it was published. But all the research programs I admire have one characteristic in common. They all predict novel facts, facts which had been either undreamt of or have indeed been contradicted by previous or rival programs. In 1686, when Newton published his theory of gravitation, there were, for instance, two current theories concerning comets. The more popular one regarded comets as a signal from an angry god, warning that he will strike and bring disaster. A little-known theory of Kepler's held that comets were celestial bodies moving along straight lines. Now, according to Newtonian theory, some of them moved in hyperbolas or parabolas, never to return. Others moved in ordinary ellipses. Halley, working in Newton's program, calculated on the basis of observing a brief stretch of a comet's path that it would return in 72 years' time. He calculated to the minute when it would be seen again at a well-defined point of the sky. This was incredible. But 72 years later, Halley's comet returned exactly as Halley predicted. Similarly, Newtonian scientists predicted the existence and exact motion of small planets, which had never been observed before. Thus, in a progressive research program, theory leads to the discovery of hitherto unknown novel facts. In degenerating programs, however, theories are fabricated only in order to accommodate known facts. As, for instance, Marxism. Ever predicted a stunning novel fact successfully? Never. It had some famous unsuccessful predictions. It predicted the absolute impoverishment of the working class. It predicted that the first socialist revolution would take place in an industrially most developed society. It predicted that socialist societies would be free of revolutions. It predicted that there will be no conflict of interest between socialist countries. The early predictions of Marxism were bold and stunning, but they all failed. Marxism explained all its failures. It explained the rising living standards of the working class by devising a theory of imperialism. It explained even why the first socialist revolution occurred in industrially backward Russia. It explained Berlin 1953, Budapest 1956, Prague 1968. It explains the Russian-Chinese conflict. But its auxiliary hypotheses were all cooked up after the event to protect Marxian theory from the facts. The Newtonian program led to novel facts. The Marxian program lagged behind the facts and has been running fast to catch up with them. To sum up, so-called refutations are not the hallmark of empirical failure, as Popper has preached, since all programs grow in a permanent ocean of anomalies. What really counts are dramatic, unexpected, stunning predictions. A few of them are enough to tilt the balance. Where theory lags behind the facts, we are dealing with miserable, degenerating research programs. Now, how do scientific revolutions come about? If we have two rival research programs, and one is progressing while the other is degenerating, scientists tend to join the progressive program. This is the rationale of scientific revolutions. But while it is a matter of intellectual honesty to keep the record public, it is not dishonest to stick to a degenerating program and try to turn it into a progressive one. As opposed to Popper, the methodology of scientific research programs doesn't offer instant rationality. Programs may take decades before they get off the ground and become empirically progressive. Criticism is not a Popperian quick kill by refutation. Important criticism is always constructive. There is no refutation without a better theory. Kuhn is wrong in thinking that scientific revolutions are sudden, irrational changes in vision. On close inspection, both Popperian crucial experiments and Kuhnian revolutions turn out to be myths. What normally happens is that progressive research programs replace degenerating ones. The problem of demarcation between science and pseudoscience has grave implications also for the institutionalization of criticism. Copernicus' theory was banned by the Catholic Church in 1616 because it was said to be pseudoscientific. It was taken off the index in 1820 because by that time the Church deemed that facts have proved it and therefore it became scientific. The Central Committee of the Soviet Communist Party in 1949 declared Mendelian genetics pseudoscientific and had its advocates, like academician Vavilov, killed in concentration camps. After Vavilov's murder, Mendelian genetics was rehabilitated. But the party's right to decide what is science and publishable and what is pseudoscience and punishable was upheld. The new liberal establishment of the West also exercises the right to deny freedom of speech to what it regards as pseudoscience, as we have seen in the case of the debate concerning race and intelligence. All these judgments were inevitably based on some sort of demarcation criterion. And this is why the problem of demarcation between science and pseudoscience is not a pseudo-problem of armchair philosophers. It has grave ethical and political implications.